This meeting is now being recorded.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to the new GTLD Subsequent Procedure Subteam Track 3, String Contention, Objections, and Disputes, held on the 7th of March, 2017. In the interest of time, there will be no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. If you are only on the audio bridge, could you please let yourself be known now? Hearing no names, I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for recording purpose, and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll turn it back over to our co-chair, Robin Gross. Please begin.
Thank you very much. Thanks to everyone for joining today's call. This is Robin Gross. Let me first review our agenda for the day. Let's see, after we complete this review, we'll discuss quickly statements of interest, update from the plenary co-chairs. The next item will be finishing up our string confusion objections, discussion about use of the SWORD tool, and then we're going to go into community issues, and in particular, discussion of the Council of Europe report that dealt with human rights and new GTLDs from their perspective, and then any other business. Is there anyone who would like to add anything or have any questions, comments about the agenda for today? Okay, well, I don't see or hear anyone, so let's just carry on. Okay, our statements of interest. Is there anyone who would like to use this opportunity to update their statement of interest? Okay, I don't see or hear anyone on that either, so let's move forward. The third item on the agenda is update from the plenary co-chair, and I believe, Aubrey, we're going to speak to that today first. Aubrey, please go ahead.
Thank you. This is Aubrey speaking. Can I be heard? Okay.
Yes, I can hear you.
I was going to assume I could. Okay. It's a very brief report at the moment. We're preparing for the Copenhagen meeting. The main item of preparation is to try and get the community comments to the CC2, which contains questions from all four of the subteams, done. We finished the first reading of it at our last meeting yesterday, and we're holding another today to do a second reading. Now, we're not sending this out for comment quite yet. What we wanted to do is have a relatively clean document for discussion in Copenhagen, because it will be the main item of the discussion, where we will first have people go through all of the questions, basically have the leaders of the subgroups go through the questions, and then we will, with the community's help, pick a couple of them for more in-depth discussion at the meeting. So at today's meeting, we will try to complete a second reading of it, so that we can get these questions out to the participants. And yes, it is beyond the document deadline for the meeting, but we have been working on these in the group for quite a while, and we will talk about them a lot in the meeting. After the Copenhagen, we will be sending out the community comment to four community comment from all the SOs, ACs, stakeholder groups, constituencies, et cetera. And if a lot of issues come up during the meeting that for substantive changes, we may do a third reading, though we've barely discussed that. I'm just sort of warning people that that's something that I certainly may suggest, but only if we make substantive changes to the questions during the Copenhagen meeting. In Copenhagen also, there'll be lots of opportunities to talk about this group and it and its work, in that there's many visits to many of the other meetings to report. So Jeff and I will be all over the place talking about these issues. I see Jeff is online and perhaps he wants to add something, but that's my update. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Avery. Is there anyone who has any questions or comments for Avery or Jeff? Looks like we've got a lot of work in front of us. All right, well, I don't see or hear anyone, so let's move forward. As noted in the chat just now, we need to switch the order of some of our agenda items. Item number 6, as currently stated, is the community issues and the discussion of the Council of Europe report. And we've got one of the co-authors of that report on the line with us, but we need to move that up in the discussion. So we're going to move that up for the next issue so the co-author can present that paper and we can have the discussion while that person can be on the call with us. So if there are no objections to that reordering, I'd like to move to that issue of the community issues and the discussion of the Council of Europe report. Okay, well, I don't see any objections to that. So let's do that, and why don't I just hand it over to one of our Council of Europe co-authors, Kinanya Pidge, I apologize for my mispronunciation there. Could you please give us a sort of an executive summary about this report and recommendations for how the group should sort of treat these issues going forward? Thanks.
Yes, of course. Could you perhaps confirm that you can all hear me?
And I confirm we can hear you.
Okay, that's perfect. Thanks a lot. So, commissioned by the Council of Europe, Eve and I have drafted this report on community-based applications for top-level domain names. For the report, we spoke with community-based applicants, with ICANN staff and the ICANN ombudsman. The report provides an overview of which universal human rights apply to communities and ICANN top-level domains, and how ICANN should have regard to human rights when assessing these applications. Human rights perspective is particularly relevant in the light of the adoption of the new bylaw in May 2016. The report shows that the community TLD process fails to adequately protect freedom of expression, freedom of association, and the prohibition of discrimination. These rights fell short in large part because due process did not meet acceptable standards. Our first finding concerns the lack of a clear vision on the purpose of community-based TLDs. So what is exactly the problem that community-based GTLDs ought to solve? So what are the public interest values that community-based TLDs ought to protect? In our report, we come with a few ideas in the direction, which would be the protection of vulnerable groups or minorities, protection of pluralism, diversity and inclusion, and consumer or internet user protection. So these are things to further discuss and think through. Related to this, we observe that there's no clear definition of the concept of community. The initially broad definition formulated by the GNSO has been severely restricted in the applicant guidebook, the Community Priority Evaluation Guidelines, and by the EIU. There are different groups of communities, such as the geographical, religious, economic, name it. They all have different modes of function. And a rigid set of evaluation criteria, as that is the case now, can be unduly restrictive with a wide variety of communities that ought to be eligible for a community GTLD. For the person that is typing, I could also send you my notes if that would save you some typing. So we have paid particular attention to the key processes affecting community-based applications. So we focused on the community objections and the community priority evaluation to assess whether these would be fair and reasonable, so with a particular focus on due process again. And we concluded that there are well-founded concerns that weaknesses in those processes may affect the human rights of community applicants. With regard to the community objections, specifically, we found inconsistency in the determination of whether entities had standing to object. Moreover, the expert and panels have applied implicit standards that ought to be made explicit to guarantee maximum predictability and align it with the intended goal of the program. With regard to the community priority evaluation, there is no external quality control on the EIU's procedures and decisions, despite this being an explicit term of the contract between the EIU and ICANN. Moreover, ICANN has devolved itself of all responsibility for determining community priority, despite the EIU insisting that it merely has an advisory role for decision making. As a result, there's no effective appeal procedure there, and ICANN's own accountability mechanisms are unable to hold ICANN or the EIU to account. We have also examined the accountability mechanisms. I'm not going into that here. You can all find that in the report. But generally, the mechanisms that are there now, so the reconsideration request, IRP, ICANN Ombudsman, and recourse to the court, have all been of very limited value to the community applicants. So the general concerns that have come up are the cost of application, the time taken to assess them, and conflict of interest, as well as a number of areas of inconsistency and lack of transparency, which have led to accusations of unfairness and discrimination. The second one is that maximum predictability ought to be guaranteed by ICANN. The third one relates to the appeal mechanism that is not there. So there ought to be an appeal on the substance of the argument and on the representativeness and eligibility of the objectors. And lastly, the lines of responsibility are unclear when it comes to delegated decision makers. So when we have a look to the future, so what are the things specifically that the court wants to focus on? So we need greater clarity as to the purpose of community CDLDs and why ICANN has created a special regime for these communities. This then should be firmly grounded in human rights. There ought to be a single appeal mechanism which can look at the substance as well as the process. Furthermore, it should be ensured that all the delegated decision makers, so for community objections, CPE, and the other accountability mechanisms, are all human rights compliant and quality controlled. It might be necessary to review the role of the EIU. The credibility of the EIU is arguably been damaged by allegations of lack of transparency, collisions with ICANN staff, and conflict of interest. It might be relevant to seek to reduce costs. And lastly, placing sufficient restrictions on the registry agreement for community CLDs to deter purely commercial interest from applying. This would shift the burden of proof so that applicants would not need to prove they were, in fact, community-based, as this would be a prima facie assumption. Instead, applications would be awarded to those who prove they have the most support from and accountability to their specific community to which they provide the benefits. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that report and all the work that went into it. Let me just open this up to the entire group. I'm sure there must be a lot of questions or comments. I know one of the sort of the threshold issues that I think we're looking at is, you know, based on the inputs that we've seen and the problems that we've seen with respect to community applications, is it a concept that we think is worth preserving going forward, this concept of certain groups being privileged by the notion of community? And if so, how do we fix it or at least address some of the concerns that have been raised in the process of the first round? So does anyone have any questions regarding this report for the author? Comments? Okay, I see in the chat, Christina says, it would be helpful to have some context for this presentation. Is the working group intended to take this as an additional input, a first among equals? Well, I don't know about first, but I think this is an initial input. We're really trying to just sort of kick off the discussion here and looking around in the community for those who have done a good bit of work and looked into this issue in some detail and, sort of starting off from, well, what have you come up with? And then I think that'll give us a good basis to have a much more robust discussion going forward. That's my personal take on that, the answer to that question. I see we've got a queue forming here, so let me just move to that. We've got Christina and then Paul. Please, Christina, go ahead.
Apologies, it took a minute to come off mute. Thank you very much. I just have a question regarding the status of the document. I will acknowledge that I'm not as familiar with the structures within the Council of Europe as I'm sure others are. I'm trying to reconcile or better understand the report standing in light of the footnote disclaimer on the cover page, and I was hoping there could be some clarification of that. Thank you.
Thank you, Christina. Kinyanya, did you want to respond to that? Can you give any clarification about that?
Yes, of course.
Before we move on.
So the report is commissioned by the Council of Europe. It has not been voted on by the member states. So it's, in that sense, an external document, expert knowledge that the Council of Europe simply wants to kickstart the discussion again. So both Eve and I are external. I'm a PhD researcher in Florence. Eve is an expert in the field of media. And we've been put forward to focus on this topic. So it's not a member state voted on document, to have that clear.
Thank you very much. Just a quick follow-up. Is the Council of Europe planning to vote on this? I just want to make sure that I have complete understanding. Thank you.
The Council of Europe, as far as I know, and I cannot necessarily speak out of their name, is not planning to vote on this. It serves a different function, let's put it that way. It's not going to be a political statement.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, let's move on in the queue, and we've got Paul. Please, Paul, go ahead.
And also thank you for the clarification on essentially the origin of this. There is, in my mind, a bit of a difference on as to whether or not this has been adopted by the Council of Europe versus merely commissioned, and I think that that's an important distinction, and so thank you for clarifying that. My question really relates to workflow between our group and Workstream 2 on human rights. I do note that this particular document jumps ahead to conclusions about which human rights may apply in the ICANN context, and those conclusions maybe are not being reached, or at least not being reached with the same certitude that this document does. And it seems to me that, we have to find some way to reconcile the work coming out of Workstream 2 on human rights with this document so that we can understand, essentially, how does our group digest a document like this when there is other work being done on this particular human rights topic in a completely different process that I think will have more direct application to board action in the future. So I don't know who to ask that question to, since the Workstream 2 is a cross-community working group rather than a PDP. If it were a PDP, I would simply take my question back to the GENISO Council and ask them that question. But since we are in a new era, I don't know. Maybe Avi or Jeff could address that how do we digest this document in light of other work that's ongoing, especially in situations where this particular document may not match up with the conclusions of those other work groups. Thanks.
Thank you, Paul. And actually, that's that is something that we had considered, and as a result, we've been in touch with the rapporteur that Workstream 2 subgroup on human rights, Niels ten Uvier, and so he is going to be joining us in this work, and we'll be meeting with him in Copenhagen and joining our discussion in Copenhagen. So we can do exactly what you just said we need to do, which is to make sure these two entirely different working groups are in fact on the same page and not going in a different direction. So you raised a good issue, but I think we've got the chair of that working group aware of it and working with us to make sure that doesn't happen. Okay, was there anyone else who has any questions or comments on this particular work item? Aubrey's got her hand up. Okay, please, Aubrey, come in.
Thank you. I just have one, and I'm not sure anybody on this meeting can answer it, but I know that the GAC – oh, this is Aubrey Doyle speaking. I know that the GAC has – discussed this report or is discussing this report, and I'm just wondering what the status of this report is within their advice formation machine. Thank you.
That's a good question, Aubrey. I do not know the answer to that, but I suspect we can try to track that answer down in the next week or so and should have an answer for our next discussion. Okay, anyone else in the queue on this? Okay, I see Jeff Newman. Jeff, please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. I put this in the chat, but it'd be good to just get the question on the record, and there was an answer to it as well. That in looking at the interviewees on the last, one of the last pages, it seems a lot of the people interviewed for this, this paper were actually individuals from organizations that have not launched yet. Their TLDs haven't launched yet. Some of them, most of them are still, may still even be in a contention or an accountability mechanism. And the question I had was, did they talk to any of the communities that have actually launched to see what the issues were and, you know, what their thoughts were on the process? And the response was that it's just those that are listed on page 75. It seems like a lot of the people that were interviewed were not satisfied with the process. So it seems like it was a little, a little sort of skewed from the outset. It would be good to get the view of those that did make it through the process to see if that changes any of the impressions. Thanks.
Thank you, Jeff. Is there anyone else who wanted to comment, questions on this report? I think it's a good place for us to kick off the discussion on this. Okay, see or hear anyone else. Let me turn it over to staff who's got some slides they want to present to us on the community applications issues more generally, and thank you to Kinyanya Pilch for joining us today and for this report. Thank you.
Hi, Robin. This is Emily Barabas from staff. Can you hear me okay?
I sure can. Go ahead.
Great. So I'm just pulling up some slides here, and this provides a little bit of background. I think this might help a little bit in terms of context for this issue area. So staff is going to provide a brief overview of sort of the topic of community applications as it was presented in the issue report. And we asked Kinyanya to go first because she had another commitment, but this will take a step back and provide a little bit of context, and hopefully that will help with the discussion as well. So I'm just going to start by talking a little bit about background for community applications. And can everyone see the slides okay? I'm actually going to scroll through myself, but let me know in the chat if you can't read. It's a little small. So in the 2012 new GTLD program round, applicants had the option of designating an application as either community-based or just regular or standard. And in the absence of string contention, that claim was taken on trust, and that was as recommended in the implementation guideline H. So implementation guideline H is one of the sort of framing pieces of this discussion. And implementation guideline F notes that in the case of string contention, without mutual agreement between applicants, a process would be put into place to enable efficient resolution of the contention. And then the third sort of foundational document that we would look at on this topic is the applicant guidebook, specifically module 4. It said that if applicants do not resolve string contention among themselves, community-based applicants may request a community priority evaluation. A panel appointed by ICANN then reviews community-based applications to determine if any fulfills the community priority criteria. So within the issue report, that's sort of the background and foundation of where the starting point that we're being asked to look at in this group. A little bit more background for those who are less familiar with the community priority evaluation. So the panel reviews and scores community-based applications against four criteria. You see those listed there, and each has a point value associated with it. And the application would need 14 points to prevail in a community priority evaluation. If a single community-based application applicant receives 14 or more points, it's given priority over all the other applications in the contention set, whereas if multiple applications meet the criteria, the AGB sets out a process for resolving the remaining contention. And there was a lot of discussion around the appropriate threshold for a prevailing score, primarily because this process is one of the few that sets up winners and losers in a sense, and so getting that number right and appropriate is pretty important to the overall process of new GTLD applications. So there were two kind of concerns that were being looked at. On the one hand, allowing applications that met the AGB criteria to pass the evaluation and give them a good shot of doing so, while on the other hand, preventing illegitimate use of a mechanism, also sometimes called gaming. And I'm sure people have lots of perspectives on that that's come up previously in conversation as well. But those were two of the things that were mentioned in the by the discussion group. And then questions and concerns related to the topic in the issue report, the discussion group raised a number of concerns about CPE. The focus was about lack of transparency, the concern that the panel misinterpreted the applications, that the panel improperly applied the CPE criteria in reaching its determinations, and an excessively high scoring threshold as defined by the AGB. And the discussion group also noted a high number of reconsideration requests from both community-based applicants that didn't prevail and non-community-based applicants that were ousted by prevailing community-based applicants. So looking at those reconsideration requests would be potentially something that the group would want to look at and seeing how this all kind of played out. And then finally, the rationale for policy development. So the working group may want to explore the topic of a community framework within the new GTLD program and seek to refine the definition of community, the concept of priority for community-based applications, the process for awarding priority, and criteria and scoring thresholds for determining if priority is applicable. And the working group could also choose to review whether the implementation of the CPE met the GNSO's intended goals, taking into consideration results of CPE cases from the 2012 round. And this presentation, we'll share it around after this, but it actually has some information as well on the presentation you just heard earlier, but I'm not going to go through that because that would be a bit redundant. So happy to answer any questions, but hopefully that frames the issue a little bit and gives you a sense of what the group is tasked with doing.
Thank you very much, Emily. Do we have any questions, comments for Emily on this presentation? Okay, I see we've got Aubrey's hand up. Please, Aubrey.
Thank you. This is Aubrey speaking. It's something I put, although with bad typos, in the chat. And I'm wondering if there are any lists or stats on the number of community applicants that went through unchallenged, those challenged that gone through, and the number that happened to be in reconsideration in IRP. I think it would be interesting to see what the stats are on the total number of communities and where they're all at in the process, just so that we have sort of a basis for this discussion of understanding that. I know some of it, but I don't know the stats. So I'm wondering if we can get those stats at some point. Thanks.
Thank you, Aubrey. Emily, did you want to respond?
Sure. Aubrey, that sounds like a very reasonable request, and it's not something we have on hand, but it's certainly something we can dig up and circulate to the mailing list. Thanks for the question.
Okay, anyone else want to get in the queue on questions for or comments for Emily on this overall laying out sort of the lay of the land on the community applications issue? We can kick off this discussion in the coming weeks. Well, I don't see any more hands or hear any voices on this. So let's move forward in the agenda, or as the case may be, move towards, and go back to what we had originally up for our next issue, which was the string confusion objections. And we had a proposal from the registries in particular that we wanted to look at with respect to string confusion objections. And do we have it up on the screen there? Okay, great. Okay. So, you know, there was concern that there was inconsistent outcomes, and there was concern that the process needed to be streamlined a little bit more effectively. So the proposal that's been put forward and is on the table for discussion is something along the following lines here, and it's on the screen as well, so you can sort of read along. An objector could file a single objection that would extend to all applications for an identical string. Given that an objection that encompassed several applications would still require greater work to process and review, the string confusion panel could introduce a tiered pricing structure for these sets. Each applicant for that identical string would still prepare a response to the objection. The same panel would review all documentation associated with the objection. Each response would be reviewed on its own merits to determine whether it was confusingly similar. The panel would issue a single determination that identified which applications would be in contention. Any outcome that resulted in an indirect contention would be explained as part of the response. And then a limited appeals process should be available to both the objectors and the respondents to handle perceived inconsistencies. Okay, so I think this is a sort of a nice proposal for us to have a discussion around. Let me just open this up and see what people think about the concerns that have been raised here and some of the elements of this proposal that have been put forward to try to address some of those concerns. Anybody want to weigh in on this? Okay, well, I don't see any hands or hear any voices, so I guess everyone's perfectly happy with the way the system works now. And we don't need to make any alterations. Okay, I'm trying to provoke discussion here. It's not working. is there anyone from the registries who participated in putting this proposal together and would like to sort of tell us what they were thinking or provide maybe a little bit of background about how this proposal came forward? Okay, I see we've got Christina's hand. Please, Christina, go ahead.
Apologies for the delay in coming off mute. Christina Rosa for the transcript. Yes, I worked on the sub-team from the registry stakeholder group that developed this proposal. And this particular one with regard to the string confusion objection was centered around the concept that the single best way to avoid inconsistent outcomes on the string confusion objection is to essentially effectively consolidate all string confusion objections for a particular string, but rather than having them be filed separately and then consolidated, that they could be filed, you know, an objector could file one objection that would apply to all applicants for the string being objected to. One way to take into account the additional time would be to introduce tiered pricing that would cover these applications. It would be one panel that would review all of the documents associated with the objection. There would be one determination that would apply to all of the applications covered by the objection, and that to the extent that there were any perceived inconsistencies, that we recommended that a limited appeals process be handled. There was some discussion about whether or not there was any unfairness in essentially requiring consolidation, because that's basically the effect of this proposal. And because the outcome, when you're talking about one applicant against another, one string, where the objection involves two pending applications, a successful objection means that the applications are put in contention, as opposed to a rejection. The view was that there wasn't as potentially significant an impact. There was some discussion within the group about whether or not there would be unfairness where you had where the objector was an existing TLD operator, because in that case, a successful objection would terminate the objected to application. Just to be clear, there wasn't unanimity within the group that worked on overall the string similarity issues as far as this proposal, there definitely was consensus on it.
Thanks very much for that background, Christina. We've got a comment from Jeff Newman in the chat who says it might help people if Christina could walk through an example, even a hypothetical example, just to take it from the abstract to the practical. Is that something you can do, Christina?
Sure. And I would say, I'm just trying to think of an example that is probably the best one would be, the one that I think clearly came out in the results of the string confusion objections was that one of the applicants for SHOP filed string confusion objections against every application for a string that had SHOP in it, whether it was SHOP, shopping, online shopping in Japanese characters, and the determinations were inconsistent. And each of those objections was handled separately. And Amazon was an applicant and is now a registry operator for online shopping in Japanese characters. And because there were more similar strings that were found not to be confusingly similar, the determination was made that a string confusion objection determination that .shop in Latin characters was confusingly similar to Japanese characters that translated to online shopping was inconsistent. And so that objection was heard by a new panel, and was reheard by a new panel, which in on the existing papers, no new papers were filed. And that second panel's determination was that there was, in fact, an inconsistency. So the idea would be in this proposal that if you had a situation where you had an applicant that wanted to file objections against multiple other applications based on string confusion, that instead of filing, you know, I think it ended up being at least five, possibly more than that, objections, the applicant could just file one objection that would cover all of the identical strings, so all of the dot chopping applications, for example. That wouldn't necessarily have affected the hypothetical I just gave you, but I think it, you know, would highlight it. So if there were, you know, car and cars, kid and kids, you would avoid a situation where you have in three cases, well, I guess that's not actually a good example if you take the plural and singular. But I think the point is that if you've got a procedure in which all of the string confusion objections that involve the exact same strings are being heard together, you just structurally minimize the possibility that you're going to get inconsistent outcomes.
Thanks, Christina. That's really helpful. Is there anyone who wants to or who thinks that we shouldn't have this sort of a consolidation mechanism, or that this we shouldn't come up with some sort of fixed inconsistent results with respect to this? Okay, I see in the chat, Paul McGrady says, what about strings that aren't exact? Did anybody want to take a stab at answering that question? I see you've got a lot of people typing. Okay, Christina in the chat says, Paul, it would still be possible to request consolidation of objections, but they wouldn't be covered by this proposal. Okay. All right. John Nevitt says the proposal also helps to avoid indirect contention sets. Yep. Okay, so it sounds like there's a good bit of support for this particular proposal going forward. Anybody else want to get in the queue on this? Christina, is that an old hand or a new hand? I see. Old hand. Okay. Okay, well, I do not see any other hands or hear any other voices, so I think we can move forward to the next agenda item, which is the recommendation with respect to the SWORD tool. And it's also part of the same proposal that's on the screen here that basically recommends ICANN do away with the SWORD tool that was presented to applicants as part of the 2012 round. There was little correlation between the SWORD results and the actual outcomes of the string similarity review and string confusion objection process, and thus that the tool was more misleading to applicants than helpful. Okay. You know, just sort of speaking personally for a moment, I am not aware of anybody who found the SWORD tool helpful at all. So I'd be really curious if there's somebody who would like to take the opposite position and think this is something we need to go forward with. Anybody want to get in the queue on the SWORD tool, doing away with the SWORD tool? Okay, I see we've got Jeff's hand up. Please, Jeff, come in.
Yeah, although not – sorry, this is Jeff Newman. Not to support the SWORD tool, but just some more context. It seems like the SWORD tool was continually updated, the formulas, such that I noticed that in one particular case, before the string similarity results were announced, the two strings that I did not think were similar had a low percentage of similarity, but somehow after the strings were announced and it became one of the sets that was found to be similar, it had a much higher percentage. So the tool kept changing. It was extremely misleading. Nobody knew what percentage implied what result. And so I agree that that tool is just should just be thrown away. Thanks.
Thanks, Jeff. Yeah, I think, it was well-intentioned, and folks thought we could come up with a helpful tool, but sometimes, what works in theory doesn't always work in practice. Okay, we see we've got Paul McGrady next in the queue. Please, Paul, go ahead.
Thanks. Paul McGrady here. I think I agree the SWORD tool should go away. It, from my point of view, increased the amount of defensive applications that people felt they had to file because of the false positives they got from the SWORD tool. Assuming that outcomes in the next round on confusion analysis track similarly to what happened in the first round, maybe with some improvements, we just have more information now about what will be considered confusing, confusingly similar to, strings, and what won't be. So the SWORD tool not only is irrelevant because we have better information now, it also wasn't terribly accurate. And I think people applied based on it that maybe they would not have applied if there had been a better tool out there, or maybe even no tool. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Paul. Is there anyone else who'd like to speak about this? Really anyone, but also I'm particularly interested to hear if there's anyone at all who thinks that we should keep the SWORD tool, and even if it's in some altered fashion. Okay, well, maybe this is a chance where we could do our green and red ticks to just sort of get a feel for the room. If you think that we need to accept this recommendation and do away with the SWORD tool, why don't you do a green tick on the Adobe chat, and so we can get sort of a record. Okay, people are ticking as we go. So far, I'm seeing no red checks, only green checks. You should do a red X if you think we should keep this in some fashion, and a green check if you think we should accept this recommendation to do away with the SWORD tool. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Okay. I'm seeing 9 green checks and no red X's. So I think that's pretty well unanimous that Greg says, can we turn the SWORD tool into a plowshare tool? Okay, so I think we've got a consensus on this one as well. And unless there's no other comments on this issue, let's move forward. Okay, I don't see or hear anyone. Okay, so next on the agenda is any other business. Is there anything else anyone wanted to bring up today? I know many of us are going to be in Copenhagen in the next week, so we'll get lots of opportunities to discuss this stuff in person next week. But we've got 10 more minutes before this call ends, so if there's any other business, that would be a good time. Oh, and Jeff reminds us, and don't forget the call in 4 hours and 10 minutes from now. All right, well, on that, I think we're done with the agenda here. I don't see any other hands for any other business, so let's call it a wrap, and we get 10 minutes back into our day, and we'll see you all online in 4 hours and 10 minutes. Thanks so much for joining. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Robin.
Bye.
Thank you. Once again, the meeting has been adjourned. Thank you very much for joining.